The Kalamazoo Institute of Arts is showing an exhibit featuring more than 30 illustrators influenced by Maurice Sendak, the author of the popular children's book Where the Wild Things Are. Michigan children's author and illustrator Matt Faulkner is one of those artists, and he's here with me on the phone. Hi, Matt.
Hey, Becca.
And Matt, we actually had to cancel our last interview because you had some ridiculous excuse.
Yeah, kind of flimsy, actually. My heart wouldn't stop beating fast, and it just wouldn't stop. So I had to go into the hospital, and it took a couple of weeks, but through medication and stuff, they were able to slow it down to a normal rate. So sorry about that. I'll do my best on this one.
But, you know,
not have any other major medical stuff happen.
And I'm so glad, and I'm really honored that you even managed to call me back, I think, the next day. But at any rate, let's talk a little bit about more about your work. This exhibit spans children's book illustrations from 1963, I think, to the present. And I know that you've done illustrations for publications like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. But when did you start getting into children's books, and why?
I graduated from the Rhode Island School of Design in 1983 and promptly packed my bags and went to New York City and got a job there in doing what they used to call paste-up, where I'd have to put type down on the on boards, and they would turn those into advertisements. And I was doing a really lousy job at it. At the same time, I had an illustrator's portfolio. But anybody who's tried to be an illustrator will let you know, it's very rare that you get out of school and immediately get books and get opportunities to do editorial illustration. You usually have to get a job like this one that I had called, you know, Paste Up. And they were about to fire me because I kept drawing on my table in, at lunch, and it would mess up the boards. And the head of the company came downstairs and looked at the drawings on my table, didn't know they were mine, and said, did we bring a professional in to do storyboards? And my boss said, no, it's this knucklehead over here who keeps drawing on his table. And he said, well, he's good. Let's make him permanent. And rather than firing me, they gave me my own office and more money. Not a lot more money, but more money. And by moving up into what they call the creative section, the people who do the other stuff, the layout they call wrists back then, and they moved me up to the creative section, I got to rub elbows with a lot of writers and art directors who were friends of editorial people and all sorts of different kinds of publishing and magazine, children's books. And that's how I met an editor who introduced me to his illustrator wife, who introduced me to her children's book editor at Scholastic. So the long, short part of that story is, because I was about to get fired, and doing what I love to do and just kept at it, I ended up getting into this thing that I really love to do, which is make these books for children.
And you actually, did you meet your wife through that business?
I did. I met my wife, Chris, who is also an author. Her name is Chris Reminar, and she's a children's librarian, back in 2006. I was currently, at that time, my son and I were packing up to move to California from Michigan. We both, I was divorced at the time, and he was going into high school, and we both said, hey, we could go, we could move anywhere, I, as long as I have, you know, a computer and a fax machine, which we used at the time for the business. I can go anywhere, so let's go move to San Francisco for a while. So just prior to doing that, Chris hired me to come visit her library for this program they called Battle of the Books. And she and I met, and I thought, wow, this is a haughty librarian. She was lovely and smart, and she was handling like 500 kids all at once with humor and grace. Even when my slide projector broke down, it was fun, just a great evening. And I, you know, I looked at her and I said, wow, I can't believe I'm moving to California when this beautiful woman is right here. So after 2 years, she and I met again when I was invited to come back to Michigan and speak to some authors and illustrators about the business. And she was one of the people at this conference. And I said, I don't care if this is kismet or whatever, I'm not letting go of this person. And so that's how we ended up being together. And I moved back to Michigan from San Francisco.
And where do you live in Michigan?
I live in a town called Lake Orion.
That's over near the Detroit area?
Yeah, it's halfway in between Flint and Detroit.
Okay. So
very lovely little town.
So you're coming to the KIA, the Kalamazoo Institute of Arts, and you're going to be reading from your book, The Monster Who Ate My Peas. And what's that about?
The Monster Who Ate My Peas was written by Danny Schnitzlein back in about 2000. And the book is about, people who read grown-up books say it has kind of a Faustian quality to it. You have this little guy who despises his peas. He just will not eat them. And one day he makes this fateful wish that he can have somebody else eat his peas for him. And this monstrous monster, pea-eating monster, he'll eventually eat any vegetables anybody asks him to eat, but you have to give him something, usually something that's very valuable to you. So he keeps eating the little hero's peas, but he also keeps taking all of his favorite stuff. And I can't ruin the story for you, but eventually he asks for something that's just too important to the little guy. So we see what happens in that particular dramatic moment. As you can imagine, the person that the monster wants, or the thing the monster wants, is the little guy's dog, Ralph. And so when the young man realizes that he's had all of these great things, his bicycle, his soccer ball taken from him, finally it comes down to his sole companion, Ralphie, the Scotty dog. He just decides, forget it about this. I'm going to just eat some peas. And he does, and the monster disappears. And I'll just say, one of the things as an illustrator is to have to decide sometimes whether or not your illustration is going to be what they call suspenders and a belt. If as an illustrator you put too much information that is exactly what is being read, it can become a little tedious. The play that you want to have between what the reader is getting through the word and what the reader is getting through the image is really the fun of trying to illustrate books. And so one thing I did at the end was the story has that the monster disappears. And the little boy decides, I'll eat any vegetable. I don't care now. I'm going to eat every vegetable that pops in front of me. But what I put into the story at the end, too, though, was that there, if you look closely at the last two pages of the book, there's a couple of monsters that are hiding, sort of camouflaged. And the reason why I did that was I wanted kids to be able to acknowledge the fact that the takeaway is that, you know what, it's great that we get the capacity to overcome issues, but new issues will show up. And rather than look at them as these overwhelming things that are going to crush us, if we look at how we sort of played our way into overcoming difficulties and took the drama out of it. And so, when I read the story to kids, it's fascinating to me, especially the 6 through 8-year-olds, because I read it to kids of all ages, but when I read it to 1st, 2nd, and 3rd graders, they immediately jump up at the end and say, there's more monsters. And I thought he got rid of the monster. And then we talk about, that happens. You get one thing fixed and something else pops up. So rather than be all terrified if things are going to keep on showing up that are frightening, just deal with one thing at a time. And I've had kids tell me that. So that's what this story is about. It took a long time to tell you, but That was really why I wanted to illustrate the story, too, because I could see it had that quality of sort of, you know, developing a fortitude and doing it with fun.
It sounds like an illustrator can really not change the meaning of a story, but really, you know, add their own elements to the story in, you know, a pretty simplistic way by, you know, what just by adding monsters, you kind of had this whole lesson that you introduced that may not have been in the book to begin with.
Yeah, you know, and that's a real tricky thing, too, because I teach at college level children's book illustration, and I can see how tempting it is for illustrators to take a story in a direction that may be fun, but if it takes it too far away from the story, the word telling of the story, that can be problematic too. That's why it's a really interesting dance, and sometimes it can be kind of clunky, and sometimes it's kind of more like jazz or ballet. You know, it is successful. So, and if you look at Mr. Sendak's work, in particular, you know, we're talking about Where the Wild Things Are and monsters. One of the things he wrote that story, so that's a different experience altogether, too, when you write and illustrate your own books. But, you know, the depth, it appears like that stuff to me when I first saw it as a kid, but certainly as I was growing up, that Where the Wild Things Are, that it just sort of appeared out of his head. You know, Where the Wild Things Are was always there. And what's really interesting to me is for a class, I designed a presentation of the story once. So I just decided to take a look through the book. And what I noticed is that as you read the book, the little boy within each frame of the page at the beginning is quite small and at the end is quite small, but his scale gets bigger and bigger and bigger as you get towards the climax in the middle of the book. And then he gets smaller again towards the end. Conversely, the artwork also starts to fill the page more. Now, the monsters are always big, but now whether or not Mr. Sendak planned that or he's just a genius and it popped out of his head and that's the way he does things, I don't really care. Well, I ask why. It's so profound. When I saw this and when I show it to students, it's like fantastic opera that he knew to do this, to create this kind of tension of the scale and show the growth of spirit in the boy when he has to confront these monsters. And when he gets back home, he kind of, you know, condenses again. That's a master right there. That is a master illustrator. And I'm so happy that people are acknowledging him. You know, everybody loves his work, I know, but to see him as a master creator, as much as somebody who just made a cute story for kids, he's so much beyond that. And I think that people are going to get that more and more over time.
And, you know, while we're on the subject, the art in Fantastic Rumpus was chosen based on the four components that we see in Maurice Sendak's work. And obviously one of them is monsters, which we just talked about, and the monster that ate my peas. Another one is portals to fantastical worlds and also unique designs to the books themselves. But the most interesting component to me is the honest depictions of children's emotions. You know, what are we talking about there? How did Sendak do that? And how do you do that in your own work?
Oh, that's a tough question. I was just going to try to make an excuse, and so I can go back to the hospital.
don't do that.
No, I won't. So Mr. Sendak actually addressed this in an interview once that I was probably 10, 15 years ago, in which he, you know, he's a pretty upfront guy. I don't know if you've seen any of the Stephen Colbert interviews with him, but he didn't, like they say, suffer fools lightly. And he basically said, you know, children, I'll put it in my own words. I don't remember exactly his. For me, kids are like little warriors. I know that sounds silly, but I don't know where they came from. I know that everybody was born from a man and a woman, but, you know, where we came from prior to that, I really have a feeling like it was not people who were frightened of fun and excitement who decided to come back here. And so if you think of children that way, you really have to honor how, the work that you're going to present to them. You can't talk down to them. You can't coddle them. If you talk to them like they are fellow brothers and sisters in arms, trying to have fun, trying to be real, trying to teach grown-ups how to be real again, you know, I think we all know what I'm talking about, how much of us, we spend so much time on our electronic devices being virtual, which is just a whole new, to me, troublesome aspect of things. We didn't need electronic devices for grown-ups to not be real. We've been doing that for a long time. But when you talk to a child, they are fully present. They are always up front. And they're always ready for fun. And so, on the one hand, for instance, in the book that I wrote, The Monster Who Ate My Peas, the monster is really kind of a scary-looking guy, more scary than I had wanted to make him. Originally, the character, and I think this is in the show, looked a little bit more like W.C. Fields than a volcano made out of vegetables with really big teeth. The issue for me was I was perfectly happy to go with this funny-looking W.C. Fields kind of monster. And the publisher got back to me and reminded me that, look, we need to be able to unsettle children a little bit in this story. If the monster does not have that quality that says, you know, sometimes things are difficult and this is how we deal with them, then the payoff is not going to be as valuable. So if you take the time to get the book from your library or go online and look at it at my website, you'll see the monster is, you know, I made a scary monster and I sent it back to the publishers. And this is a publishing company down in Atlanta, and they were all very sweet-voiced people from Atlanta, you know, very soft. And they were very happy. Oh, he's terrifying. Go ahead. That's great. You know, that's okay. Fine. So that's how I feel about working for children. I know it sounds, it's a little bit, and I'll finish just by saying, it's a little bit like a bumper sticker, but I swear, honestly, Rebecca, I really do feel that way. They are teaching us with their courage on a daily basis. And I don't mean like serious, you know, it's how ridiculous they'll be, even though they know they have to go to the dentist, or, you know, or how happy they'll be goofing around after they've just left the dentist. When as grown-ups, I'll be thinking about being at the dentist's office for the next 3 weeks because it hurt for a little while. You know what I mean? They have that kind of warrior capacity to stick with the moment and have fun. And that's what I really dig about making work for kids.
You know, that brings up an interesting point. Thinking about my own experience as a kid, and I am a little bit younger, and I did have Where the Wild Things Are read to me, you know, and I enjoyed that book because of that aspect of it scares you just a little bit. You know, why do kids enjoy things like that?
Oh, I don't know. They're weird. Okay, I'll answer that question too. One of the things I remember Mr. Sendak saying is that children are aware of the subtlety of life, that there is a hell of a lot more stuff going on than grown-ups will allow themselves to acknowledge. Life is very subtle. And a lot of the things, a lot of the really important stuff will be caught out of the corner of your eye. I'm paraphrasing what he said, and I think I'm actually adding some things that other smarty pants people like Jung and Joseph Campbell and poets have said. But the kids don't, and Harry Houdini said, you know, you can't fool kids because they always know, their eyes are always open. And so So I think that's why children want to have us in on their reality, their understanding of reality, which is, you know what? That's why we have depictions of creatures we call ogres and giants and vampires, and because children recognize that, and without getting too esoteric, that there are those kinds of energies in the world. And, you know, a dwarf, in a mythic sense, is not necessarily just a short person, but humanity in a condensed form, which is tremendously powerful. Now, if you look at that as a metaphor, that is the way when I talk to children, they perceive the vast energies of the world that we're in. And there's a great Jungian therapist named Robert Johnson, and he asked kids once, "What is a myth?" And a kid and a young boy, 8 years old, stood up and said, "A myth is something that's not true on the outside, but is true on the inside." Now, kid was probably Albert Einstein in disguise or something, but to me, see right there, that is child master poetry. Children are popping up with that kind of stuff all the time, and we don't listen to them because, come on, we've changed the definition of the word myth. It means something, it doesn't mean something that is in its core absolute truth. It means something that throughout, from the outside all the way in, is just sort of silly and meaningless, when the original meaning was closer to what that 8-year-old boy said. And so, yeah, that's, to me, that's why kids want to sit with us and hear these mythic stories and hear newer ones and older ones, because it's us being brave enough to sit with them and say, "I recognize that this world, while not on the same level of, I don't know, reality for me as a grown-up as reality, it's still potent. It's still important." I don't know. Does that all sound too esoteric?
Absolutely not. You have a new book coming out called Gaijin, and hopefully I'm pronouncing that correctly, American Prisoner of War. And this is a story that is somewhat realistic and is very personal for you. Could you talk about that?
Yes, I can. Gaijin, during just prior to World War II and during World War II, was a derogatory word for Japanese to call anybody who was not fully Japanese or trying to act like they were Japanese. So if it would be like any of the other slander, racial slander words we can use now, was insulting in the extreme. That has changed. If you go over it, you can hear people call somebody gaijin, and mostly it means somebody who's on the outside. So that's the way I took the word now, both in its original or earlier definition and what people think of it now. So just as outsider, to be an outsider in America. And I will just say that I was 10 years old. I started to read a bunch of books about kids who were in the Holocaust. Why I decided to, I don't know, I have a tendency to kind of get fixated on stuff. Maybe that's why my heart kept on beating real fast, because it was having fun and just kept feeling like doing it. But I wouldn't necessarily say these Holocaust books were fun, but I just recall just relating to these children and wanting to hear how they escaped, how they survived, how they, you know, and it was kids all over the place. It was kids in North Africa. It was kids in Italy. It was kids in England. It was kids in America. But one thing I didn't know about was the Japanese-American internment during World War II and what that meant. And I got a big wake-up call, because one day my mother, who was getting these books for me at the library, said, you know, your aunt was in a concentration camp with your second cousin. She's really my mother's aunt, so and her daughter, Mary. It was my great aunt Adeline and my daughter Mary, during World War II, were placed in Manzanar, the Japanese American internment camp in Eastern California, very close to Death Valley, right at the feet of the Sierra Mountains. And I said, I remember at the time thinking, Mom, come on, I've done a lot of research on this. There were no concentration camps in America. I just wish you'd do more reading. And she showed me this little piece of paper that said the return address. It was just from an envelope, and it was from my Aunt Adeline. It was the last letter my mom had received in the late 1960s from Aunt Adeline. And she said, that's her. And we didn't hear much from them after World War II. But you just need to know that that's the reality of your family. They were in a prison camp because your cousin was Irish and Japanese American, and she was just the wrong race at the wrong place in the wrong time. So 25, 30 years passed, and I didn't think much about it. I would look every once in a while, but until the advent of the internet, you know, it would be costly to try to locate somebody. So I would make inquiries and talk to my mother about it every once in a while, but it fascinated me. And with the internet, I started to look every once in a while and plug in different combinations of my Aunt Adeline's name, and still couldn't find anything. But about 2006, 2007, I decided that even though I'd never done anything like that before, I was going to make a graphic novel, and it was going to be about a mother and a child being interned in a California internment camp because they were part Japanese. Since I had nothing to go on besides the fact that my mother had hung around with Mary when they were both 8 or 9 years old, when Mary came and Adeline came back to visit her family. And I'll tell her story in a second. I'm going to tell you what happens in the actual Gaijin story. Since I didn't know about Mary and Adeline, I just knew their names. And since, you know, I had a teenage son, I figured it'd be smarter for me to tell a story based upon my own experience, closer to my own experience. So I decided to be a mother and a boy who his father gets a telegram from his own father, who is still in Tokyo. They're living in the mother and son, Adeline and Koji, are living in San Francisco. And the father gets a telegram that says, your dad is sick, and we need help reorganizing the family business, which is a button-making company in Tokyo. And can you come home for a while? And this is the beginning of 1941, January. So they get money from him and hear from him for 6 months. And then in August of 1941, everything stops. And then the fateful day, December 7th, Japanese Imperial Navy and Air Force attack Pearl Harbor and destroy several of a big chunk of our Navy and killed close to 2,000 American service people. And it also just happens to be Koji's birthday. He turns 13 that day. And so the story talks about his experience as a Irish-Japanese-American boy who has freckles and it looks Japanese to people with light-colored skin, but to Japanese Americans, in particular the boys he bumps into and in the first camp that he's in, he looks more like he's white because he's got freckles and brownish hair and blue eyes. And he kind of gets it from both ends. People immediately start taunting him and harassing him in San Francisco, and that happened to a lot of Japanese Americans. Prior to them being shipped off to the internment camps. And he then is sent to a camp, and the boys in the camp, Japanese-American boys, decide that he's a spy, and they harass him for a little while. And the story is essentially how he is able to, with the help of a good friend, an older man, and his mother, her unending help to him, in the story, one of the most awesome things about my Aunt Adeline that I also put in the story was the fact that Mary, her daughter, and Koji in the book got the letters from the government that said, because of your ancestry, you have to go to a concentration, or you have to go to a, they call them relocation camps. And Adeline didn't get the letter. So Adeline went down to the Army office and argued with the Army, and they said, well, your kid's got to go. Sorry. Because, you know, we just can't trust the Japs right now, so we got to do what we got to do. They didn't put it that way. They said, it's actually for their own protection. But you know what? If you really, really don't want your son to go by himself or your daughter, you can go too. We'll make allowances for you to go even though you're not Japanese. And so Adeline did. She packed her stuff and went to the camp. And I have everlasting admiration for her. I can't imagine as a parent doing otherwise, but still, I can just imagine that moment. You know, they had 3 weeks to pack up everything. They could only take 2 bags with them. They had to sell everything they owned. The FBI came in and took their radios, anything that looked like it was Japanese, anything, any letters, wedding photos. They took anything that could be used as a weapon, like baseball bats. And people had 3 weeks to get all of this done, get on a bus or a train, and get sent to, in the case of Manzanar, it's out, like I said, near Death Valley. When my son and I visited there in 2010 in May, it was 102 degrees. And it goes down to 20 degrees at night in the winter. And these were, like they say, tar paper shacks. And these weren't, you know, tough farmer fisher people. These were suburbanites from L.A. and San Francisco, doctors, lawyers, all just got stuck in these shacks for 3-4 years. And I've read interviews with some of the guards who were, they were ashamed to say that they would do things like they would turn the big Klieg lights, the searchlights, in towards the camp. They were supposed to be looking out, but they didn't, because that's not really, even though they were, the Japanese Americans were told the reason why they're there is to protect them, but that wasn't the reason. It wasn't the reason at all. It was because they, like I said, were just the wrong race at the wrong place at the wrong time. And the guards used to shine the lights in the windows to keep them up, to the little thing they would say is slap a Jap, anything they could do to make life a little more difficult. The other thing was is that, you know, the big 50-millimeter machine guns, all of the people who were being interned were told those machine guns on the towers are meant for to keep anybody who might want to harass you out. But the fact was is that the machine guns were pointed inward into the camp. And so that became a question as to why are the machine guns pointed in if they're supposed to protect us? So it's a chunk of American history that is difficult to hear. It was difficult to figure it out, I don't think I figured it out yet, but to piece it all together and try to make a story out of it. Because on a daily basis, you know, to think about, wow, we did this to us. These were American citizens. You know, 120,000 people. 3/4 of them were American citizens. 2/3 of them were kids under the age of 14.
And how do you create that balance between, I mean, obviously this is still a children's book, you know, though adults might read it too. You know, how do you keep that balance between getting these kids the information that they really should know about this historical event that took place, while also doing that parental thing of, you know, maybe leaving out some of the gore and, you know, some of the things there? Or is that an important thing that we should do? Or should we just show reality as it is?
You know, I just watched Alfred Hitchcock's North by Northwest while I was sitting in the hospital. My heart was thumping away. And there were so many instances where violence could have been put right up in our faces in that story. So many items, people getting hit, somebody getting shot. And what I really valued about watching that was that a little bit of mystery is so nice. The gore that we see now, the, you know, like they say in the computers, you know, you have access to 40 million colors when you look at your screen. The clarity of sound, the bells and the whistles and the in-your-face constantly of detail, and you need to know everything about everything all the time or else you're in big trouble. You better stay tuned. You know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
When writing a story, especially for children, I like to think about that Alfred Hitchcock skill of, well, he showed one instance where a man got shot. And at the time the man was shot, he was stepping on another man's fingers who was trying to make him fall off a cliff. Now, he didn't show the bullet hitting the man and the man screaming and falling over. What he showed was the foot easing up and then the foot falling over. And I thought, they couldn't do that nowadays. We'd have to see everything from 10 different angles,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so the poetry, the haiku quality, what to show and what not to show, I think leaning towards a little more conservative is a tricky word right now, but a little more a limitation in that is not a bad thing. But that doesn't mean don't address the issue. If there's violence, you know, we got to talk about it. Put it on the coffee table and make it a subject, as they say, you know?
Right.
And kids will deal with it. Kids have no problem with it. It's the constant over and over and over of too much scary images that I have issue with. It's not the violence itself. It's the intoxication and addiction to the roller coaster ride. I've got to feel like I'm going off the edge of that roller coaster over and over and over again. And I think the pleasure in that, it is like a drug. It ends sooner than we'd like to think. So we got to see more and more and more. So I'll get off my soapbox on that. But I just, you know, in actually writing the story, there were a couple of moments. There's one where Koji says something outrageous to his mother. He tells her that she's a camp floozy. And she is outraged. It's like the third or fourth time that he's sort of stepped to her and been rude in this way. And it's just not like him. And he's just over the top with him in this point, and she slaps his face. And, you know, I sent the sketches to my editor, and I sent them to my wife. You know, we talked about them. You know, Chris is a children's librarian and an author, and my editor, it's her job to, you know, really pay attention to this stuff and really let's think it through. And that was one of the issues. You know, it's like there's also another point where Koji gets hit by one of the boys a couple of times. Do we need to show this? To what degree, if we do, to what degree do we have to show it? So with the issue of him being slapped by his mother, there's just one frame where he's whacked across the face. And then, you know, he takes off and she is just terrified and mortified that she's done this to her own son. And he runs out into the dark, into the camp, and she calls after him. And, you know, she apologizes to him later, even though, you know, his behavior was terrible. Does it warrant being slapped? No. I never, you know, since I was a kid, I recognized that parents slapping children is just teaching people that hitting makes right. However, the fact that he was so rude, some other consequence might have been a good thing. Not hitting, but so it's, you know, putting this stuff in books for children to review and talk about. Again, that's the kind of play, the dance you got to do. We went back and forth. My editor at first said, no, I don't think it's a good idea to show her hitting him. And I said, hey, I know that my parents got slapped by their parents. It was a thing people did back then. My parents were alive in the 40s and 30s. People did it for quite some time. Some people still do it. Again, let's make it a subject and talk about it. Is it okay to do that?
And the ability of parents to make mistakes.
Yeah, and say, I'm sorry. And how can I fix this?
So I only have one last question. You know, what do you think makes a good illustrator?
What do I think makes a good illustrator? Somebody who is lit up by the internal archetypes in their own world, inside. an illustrator for me. Now, there are all kinds of illustrators. There are illustrators who are very, very good at sharing other people's or more surface information. Nothing wrong with it. You look at Norman Rockwell. He's telling us a story about a particular moment, and it's the detail, it's the quality of rendering that is overwhelming to me. But when I look at another illustrator named one like Arthur Rackham, or another guy named Dulac, and lastly, I'll give you a third name to look up, Sidney Syme. These are people who not only have learned how to render a moment, have studied anatomy, have learned the rules and learned how to bend them. They are also fascinated by this mythic world, which is both, as the philosophers say, without and within. You can be educated by the giants that are within, as well as the people who are, like Nelson Mandela, the giants of spirit without. And a good illustrator to me, that's one that I appreciate. It's like I was saying, I'm blown away by Norman Rockwell. I look at his work and do my best to learn from him as often as I can. But it's these people who also do this brave inward movement to talk to the inner entities, the ghosts, the vampires, the giants, the benevolent wizards, the not-so-benevolent wizards, the witches inside. Call them whatever names you want, but the ones who do that are going back to their own childhood and saying, I don't care that grown-ups told me that this was a silly thing to do or it was a bad thing to do or I shouldn't live in this part of myself at least once in a while. People who go in that way and they have the courage to do that, I salute.
As do I. And thank you so much for talking with me. And you are going to be reading on December 14th, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
At the Kalamazoo Institute of Arts, and then your work, along with more than 30 other illustrators, will be up at the Kalamazoo Institute of Arts until, I think, through January.
Yes.
So thank you so much for talking with me.
You bet. And I just want to plug the other illustrators who are there. They are, I'm inspired by them. The artwork that they've got in the show is a must-see. So go see these other illustrators. They're fantastic.
All right. Check them out.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you.